This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, some unironically good news about the 2016 election. One quarter of the country looks set to fully legalize marijuana in November. So if you're bummed about the outcome, at least you can still get stoned.
Yes, you can. Also, we recap the week's big intelligence news, including what could be a new surveillance program being run out of Yahoo and the arrest of a spy contractor accused of stealing government secrets. Investigative reporter Marcy Wheeler is on to discuss.
And it's Friday, folks, so that means the garbage can is getting ready. That's right, we're filling it to the brim with banana peels, chicken carcasses, and bags of doo-doo that dog walkers have thrown in. It's extra stinky this week, so, and our candidates are too, folks. You won't want to miss it.
Is Harper responsible for any of that doo-doo?
Please don't dox my dog.
Nobody would have known until you said that. All right, first, though, let's talk about the election here. Saturday in Wisconsin, Fall Fest. Head up there, folks, if you want to see Paul Ryan get cucked. Shout out to our alt-right listeners, just trying to speak your language, trying to connect with the young alt-righters.
No, we just like the word cuck.
Yeah, we do. Look, the Speaker of the House is appearing with Donald Trump for the first time on the campaign trail. Politico reporting that Ryan and Trump will attend the annual Fall Fest in the Speaker's first congressional district alongside Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, several top Republican state officials, and Senator Ron Johnson, a guy who is in a tough reelection fight this fall. You know, we've criticized Clinton for not trying to attach enough down ballot Republicans to Trump. Here's Ron Johnson doing it himself, attaching himself to Trump in Wisconsin. So we got this whole party unity thing going on Saturday in Wisconsin. And really, I called this 6 months ago that Trump was going to win the nomination. And after he does, all these Republicans were going to fall in line, even ones who didn't seem like they would. Those who fought with Trump the hardest. I said that they would all eventually fall in line. And here we have Ron Johnson. Here we have Scott Walker. Here's the Speaker of the House, all on the campaign trail with the Donald.
I guess the only difference really between Donald and the other Republicans is that the other Republicans are cucks.
Yeah.
They're the same. Just
and perhaps the biggest one of all here, Ted Cruz, who has finally come around to endorsing Donald Trump. Means maybe Sheldon Adelson will let him into the private suite now. As we know, Ted Cruz was denied access to Sheldon Adelson's private suite at the RNC after Ted Cruz pulled that stunt telling people to vote their conscience.
Vote your conscience. Vote up and down the ticket.
I will admit, though, these Republicans aren't quite as enthusiastic with their Trump endorsements as I imagined. I mean, here was Ted Cruz stopping by the GOP headquarters in Tarrant County, Texas, this week to phone bank on behalf of the Republican ticket. And notice a name that Cruz never mentioned during the entire call. This is from the Washington Post.
Hi, this is Ted Cruz calling. I was calling to encourage you to come out and vote on Election Day. This election is critical for the direction of our country, and I urge you to come out and support freedom, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. You can vote by absentee ballot, and if you need help getting an application for an absentee ballot, the Republican Party of Texas can help you with that. Or you can vote in person. I just wanted to encourage you to come out and vote. Thank you, and God bless you.
Yeah, missing a name there.
Yeah, no mention of Donald Trump in that entire phone call. So maybe he won't be back invited back into the suite now that I think about it.
Yeah. By the way, if you got that phone call, wouldn't you think it was a robocall at first?
Are you making fun of Ted Cruz's voice?
No.
Oh, you would just think it was a recording of Ted Cruz's voice, that it wasn't actually him.
No, I'm not trying to truth here. I'm not trying to, you know, create a conspiracy theory. I'm just saying, if I got a phone call like that, and he didn't seem to, that didn't seem to be really much of a conversation. He's just like, hi, this is Ted Cruz.
Well, maybe he was leaving a voicemail.
Maybe.
That'd be quite a surprise, though, to pick up the phone and it's Ted Cruz.
Yeah.
I'd advise against Ted Cruz doing that in the future. Who knows who's going to lay into him when he does that next time. Speaking of that, Paul Ryan's team nearly did the same thing In announcing this campaign stop on Saturday with Donald Trump, Politico notes that, quote, Trump's inclusion in the event was announced almost as an afterthought. After listing the other politicians attending, the release from Ryan's political team read, presidential nominee Donald J. Trump will also join Wisconsin Republicans at the 1st Congressional District Republican Party of Wisconsin Fall Fest, adding, quote, all questions related to Mr. Trump should be directed to the Trump campaign. So it was kind of a, oh, by the way, our Republican presidential nominee is going to be here, too. You know, normally that sort of person would headline an event.
Yeah.
Here he was, an afterthought. And also, we're not fielding any questions on Trump. Please don't make us explain why we're subjecting ourselves to public ridicule, appearing next to one of the most reviled presidential candidates in history.
They're trying to go half-cuck.
Yes.
I would just like to point out, by the way, very quickly, the alt-right, you know, the deplorable people, they use cuck as like, you know, as a term to describe Republicans who won't support Trump, whereas we have kind of appropriated it. And now we call Republicans who said they wouldn't support Trump, but now are supporting Trump. Now they're cucks.
Yeah, my definition is just basically people who are being humiliated by Donald Trump and keep like going back to him for more.
Yeah.
Okay, so this GOP show of unity arrives just ahead of Sunday night's debate. Clinton v. Trump, round two. Trump's polling numbers have been in a tailspin since the first debate. Since like 90 million people watched him manically defend how rich he was for an hour and a half. Perhaps recognizing that, Trump put out a desperate appeal on the campaign trail on Thursday to lock up the terminally ill voting bloc. Here he was desperately pleading with dying people to vote for him.
I don't care how sick you are. I don't care God. If you just came back from the doctor. And he gave you the worst possible prognosis, meaning it's over. You won't be around in 2 weeks. Doesn't matter. Hang out till November 8th. Get out and vote. And then all we're going to say is we love you and we will remember you always. Get out and vote.
Get out and vote.
I'm surprised he didn't encourage them to vote early before they died in case they die before November 8th. But either way, that's spoken like a man who knows he's truly not doing well with millennials.
Yes. Yes. Trump's get out of the vote operation will be people like running around with adrenaline shots, like injecting it in people, dying people and getting them out to the bull. This is very dark.
Yeah,
very dark
let's
stuff
move
here.
On.
I'm not even going to go after this joke I wrote into the script. I'm just going to move on here. A couple of things I don't understand about this whole thing, especially what's going on in Wisconsin with Paul Ryan jumping in behind Trump. We know Paul Ryan has sort of endorsed Trump for a while now, but now appearing on the campaign trail with him, along with Ron Johnson, who's a senator in a bitter fight to keep his seat. You would think the last person he wants to be seen with is Donald Trump right now. Yet here he is going on the campaign trail. And I can understand if Trump is peeling off more of these traditional Republicans, if he was close, or if he's winning in the polls, if he's on a good trajectory. After all, it's good to get behind a winner. You want to be supporting a guy who's going to win, because when he wins, he'll remember who was supporting him or her. But Trump is not doing well in the polls. Trump is doing very badly in the polls. Ever since the first debate, he's getting creamed in pretty much every battleground state. And if the second and third debates mirror the third debate, he's going to get blown out, or at least blown out in terms of how presidential elections work in the U.S. right now, which would be a, you know, 7, 8, 9 point win for Hillary Clinton. That would be a blowout. In this case, Republicans, you know, who took a stand against Donald Trump, who recognized basically what most rational people have recognized, which is that he would be a disastrous president. Those people, they'd look awfully smart when Trump is indeed trounced in the polls. People who withheld their support for Trump, knowing that he's a bad candidate. But that's not what's happening. Instead, those people are coming around to support Trump now that he's losing in the polls pretty soundly. As Trump performs worse, the pressure within the GOP to support him grows. After all, Trump is not a unique force existing outside the Republican Party. He is a Republican through and through, from his racism and his sexism down to his economic policies of deregulation and tax cuts for the rich. He's just a completely unqualified Republican to be president. And by the way, a similar pressure is taking hold on the left for people to get in line and fall behind Hillary Clinton. But facing what could be a resounding GOP defeat in November, Republicans seem more than willing to go down with the ship, to sink with Trump. Good for them.
Just wanted to say really quickly, you mentioned Paul Ryan. There's a danger to not supporting Trump, which is you could get John Boehnert.
That's true.
You could face insurgency from the right and be primaried. You could get Dave Bratted, I can't even remember his name. Eric Cantor, that's his name.
Yes, like Eric Cantor got.
What's his name?
Okay, let's turn now to some economic news for the 99%.
Whole street! Our street! Whole street! Our street! Whole street! Our street!
One of the largest quasi-legal markets in the country could get a boost this November. And if you're a fan of this show and the two clowns who produce it, you probably already know what we're talking about.
In the words of Dr. Dre, smoke weed every day.
I don't even know what that is, weed. Not even sure what that means. Five states could...
Perhaps you know it by another name.
Perhaps. Either way, five states could fully legalize marijuana next month in referenda that could see 1 in 4 Americans living under jurisdictions where recreational prohibition is repealed. Massachusetts, Arizona, Maine, and Nevada, pronounced it right, are all holding ballot measures on the issue. And in all four states, polling shows the two sides are neck and neck. That's according to a story published on Tuesday by The Hill. Voters in California, however, the first state in the union to approve of medicinal marijuana, they look set to greenlight legalization by a landslide, with the anti-prohibition vote getting 60% in the polls. Now, while we can say for certain that this would only imply that this would impact supply within California, the state is a huge player in America's gray market cannabis industry and would surely reverberate somewhat around the nation. Last year at $2.7 billion, Californians bought and sold almost half of all medicinal marijuana in the U.S. The northern part of the state is known for its high-quality products cultivated by countercultures that, sadly, appear set to become collateral economic damage in the event of legalization. And Congressional Research Service has estimated that the end of prohibition would see the pre-tax retail price of cannabis drop in the state by between 50 and 80% to $100 to $150 per ounce on average.
Jeez.
Yeah. You remember when a dime bag used to cost a dime?
Whoa. Easy there, Willie Nelson.
Anyway, this is all a nice reminder that even if you hate Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, congressperson and their challenger, your senator and their challenger, your mayor, your city councilman, your dog catcher.
Okay, we get it. We hate all our elected officials.
Anyway, you can still vote for weed in those five states. This is a reminder there are still reasons to participate next month in the electoral process. By the way, one pro-mass incarceration Republican in Arizona seems to think that low turnout is on his side. If the pro-legalization side is not at 55% at this point, it will likely lose, said Sean Noble to The Hill. We know that polling on legalization generally overperforms actual results.
Is that a knock on stoners who forget to vote or something? They respond to all the polling and then they just don't go and hit the election booth?
I don't know how I can say anything other than yes. It does look like stoners are spacing on the date.
I will say in reference to your, you can hate all the candidates on the ballot, but you can at least vote weed. I think it was 2014 in Washington, D.C. when we had the ballot measure to legalize recreational use of marijuana.
That's right, yeah.
There were also a lot of Green Party candidates on that ballot, so I was able to vote green all the way down.
Nice.
Yeah.
You know,
proud of that voting.
You know who you probably voted for?
Who?
Our fellow co-host, our colleague, Eugene Currier.
Yes, I did. I did not vote for Vincent Orange at the time.
Ah.
Which is another color that was on the ballot.
Indeed. In related matters, it appears the Drug Enforcement Administration has cold feet over its proposed kratom ban. the health website Stat and a Texas NBC affiliate, KCENT-TV, are both reporting that the DEA has relented in the face of public outcry and is not enforcing its ban on kratom, which was scheduled to take place on September 30th, last week. The agency had said in late August that it was adding kratom to its Schedule 1 list of controlled substances, and the move led to a White House.gov petition that got over 100,000 signatures and an outcry from 51 members of Congress and 9 senators. Lawmakers had asked the White House to rule the DEA's move illegal on the grounds that the agency did not open the rule proposal to public comment. Now that is something that seems likely, according to the reports. An official familiar with the decision said the DEA was now considering instituting a period of public comment or taking the more traditional approach to banning drugs, as what Stat noted. The DEA had alleged that kratom posed what it classified as a public health crisis, which is something that gave it the authority to unilaterally ban the herb-based opioid substitute for 2 to 3 years. When issuing its edict, however, the agency could only cite 15, quote, kratom-related deaths between 2014 and 2016, and the cause of those fatalities have been disputed by critics, and there have been tens of thousands of deaths annually in the past few years from prescription opioids alone, most of which are considered by the DEA to be more dangerous than kratom as Schedule II controlled substances. Still messed up that they would try to ban it, but at least, I don't know, this is really good news about kratom. Anecdotally, it seems like a relatively safe substitute to opioids and has a potential as a cure for withdrawal. So I think it's good news. The DEA appears to not be ramming this through right now.
And it looks like making a lot of noise about this, as a lot of people have made a lot of noise about that, has stopped this move in its tracks for now. More dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you from Washington, D.C. This week, two interesting stories dealing with intelligence matters broke. The first, news of an arrest of a contractor at Booz Allen who worked at the NSA and is charged with exfiltrating top secret information. Talked about on the show yesterday, the arrest took place at the end of August. The criminal complaint against 51-year-old Harold Thomas Martin states that he's facing charges for unauthorized removal and retention of classified material and the theft of government property. Also this week, we learned of what could be another domestic government surveillance program, this one involving Yahoo. Reuters reported that the web giant last year secretly built a program to search all of its customers' incoming emails for specific information at the request of U.S. intelligence officials. That involves scanning hundreds of millions of Yahoo mail accounts. So where does this new discovery fit into what we already know about the U.S. surveillance state? Joining us now to make sense of both of these stories is investigative journalist Marcy Wheeler. You can read her reporting on numerous online outlets, but primarily check out her blog at emptywheel.net. Hi, Marcy.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Doing well. So first, let's talk about the arrest of Mr. Martin, the Booz Allen contractor. Going over the criminal complaint against him, did anything stand out or raise any particular questions for you?
No, and I think the most interesting thing is this guy was arrested back in August 27th, and the government, he's been in custody since then, and the government hasn't gotten any further in its investigation slash charging of him since then, at least not such that they're charging him for. One thing that is probably happening is he is trying to get a plea deal. And so the government is probably avoiding any indictment for this bunch of legal issues going on. But I think the really interesting part of this is that we learned about this guy because a bunch of big name New York Times reporters reported that a guy who might be the source for the shadow brokers leak, which if you recall, were a bunch of really important hacking tools from the NSA that were released back on August 15th. And so the New York Times created the impression that this guy might be the source of those documents, DOJ unsealed this complaint from back in August that was the basis for his arrest. And since then, we've learned that the guy is basically a hoarder. He seems to have been taking a bunch of documents out of NSA. He's getting a PhD on basically hacking. And the most logical explanation at this point is he was just bringing stuff home to work on his dissertation improperly, but doing it because he worked at Booz Allen on stuff that he's writing his dissertation on. And the reason this is a big stink is because people at the FBI probably wanted to leak and lead to the impression that they'd found the shadow brokers guy. And there's no reason to believe that this guy, that this Martin guy is actually the shadow broker source.
Can you just briefly explain to our listeners what the shadow broker, what the shadow broker situation is, what that whole incident is about? Because it does seem like they are really concerned in, or at least wanting to appear ahead of this story by sort of talking about the secret investigation to the Times, as you mentioned.
Right. So again, back on August 15th, a security guy said, hey, there's a mysterious entity called the Shadow Brokers, and they claim to be selling what they're billing as Equation Group, which is kind of nickname for NSA's hackers. They're selling or offering up what they claim to be the Equation Group's hacking tools. And these tools were unbelievably sensitive. They basically were tools to crack into the firewalls of major American companies that get sold to Chinese and Russian and European, but also American companies. So in other words, tools to be able to hack a huge group of businesses and also big parts of the federal government itself. And when this happened, it was like there were two really important issues about this. One is, why was NSA using these tools, sitting on these tools, rather than going to companies like Cisco and saying, hey, you've got this huge vulnerability, and your job is to keep not just European but also American companies safe. Please patch this vulnerability so that these American and European and Chinese and Russian companies will be safe. Instead, the NSA sat on them for years. These files date from at least 2013 and some of them older. So NSA's been just like not telling Cisco and Juniper and some other American companies that they've had these vulnerabilities, and they've been letting American companies sell their security products with these vulnerabilities that make their customers vulnerable to hacking. So that's an outrage. And it raises questions about what's called the vulnerabilities equity process, which is what Obama has rolled out to try and pretend that NSA doesn't weaken security. There's supposed to be a trade-off going on, and clearly these files were not considered for any kind of trade-off. So the NSA made lots of businesses really unsafe, and that should be a huge scandal. We're not really talking about that. And then there's the more obvious question, which is how did they get released? And the working theory is that somebody was in a forward deployment, so working from a place not in the NSA, trying to hack a target, say China or Russia, and they basically had a giant toolkit of hacking tools with them. And it's as if the plumber left your kitchen after fixing your sink and left his toolkit there, except that the toolkit happens to be not fixing leaks, but creating leaks, and happens to be really dangerous. So the plumber's toolkit left somewhere on the internet. Somebody found it, released it. So that's the working theory. But probably what happened is when NSA learned that these files were out there, they searched around for anyone who might have had them and found this Martin guy and said, oh, he's somebody we have suspicions of, all of a sudden. And they say this guy may have been hoarding documents for 10 years. Mm. So, right, that's the other scandal. Yes, the only thing that he has in common with Edward Snowden, as far as we know, is that they both worked for Booz Allen Hamilton, which does a huge amount of NSA's hacking. Well, you know, we should ask whether it's a good idea to have contractors doing our government hacking rather than having actual government employees. But Booz does a lot of that. They also do a lot of spying on targets, that not just hacking. So anyway, the big issue is that Booz is a huge contractor, a huge part of NSA's business, and they can't seem to stop their employees from robbing the government, which is a bit of a problem. In response, people like Adam Schiff, the California congressman who's a ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee. He's like, oh, yeah, we need to fix the insider threat program, which means more lie detector tests and more online scans. And it's like, no, you probably need to fix the Booz Allen Hamilton problem. You know, you probably need to fix that problem. The NSA employees are already being scrutinized enough. It's Booz that is your problem, but whatever.
Hey, Booz is overdue for a good performance after two huge leaks, you know, maybe one day.
Right. And the other thing is that, you know, assuming Martin is not the source of the shadow brokers tools, right, then probably there's another guy out there in the immediate vicinity of Snowden, this other guy who was also stealing files or finding files. So it may be there's a third leaker, in which case, you know, NSA has. And here's the thing is, like, if these people can leak and either give them to journalists, as Edward Snowden did, or put them in their shed, as Martin did, we should assume there are many people who are doing the same thing, but giving the documents to the Russian or Chinese, and that, you know, we're not keeping very good secrets from them at all, because, you know, it seems like everyone can wander out of the NSA with documents.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it'll be interesting to see these forthcoming proceedings against Mr. Martin, especially considering how we've seen the Justice Department treat other people for mishandling classified information recently, including David Petraeus and Hillary Clinton, versus how we've seen them treat people who give documents to journalists like Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. I want to turn now to the Yahoo story.
Wait, can I make a really quick point about that? Because it's sort of interesting.
Yes, please do.
So Edward Snowden, Booz employee, they charged him in Virginia. Martin, Booz employee, they charged him in Maryland, where he and technically Snowden worked. And that's one indication of what you just said. Probably the place to charge Snowden would have been Maryland, where Fort Meade is and where this Booz location is. But DOJ has a lot of it really exotic stuff that they do at DOJ in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is kind of the CIA's home district. And so, yeah, it reflects that. They went after Snowden in the district where they do a bunch of legal things that are kind of cutting edge. This guy, they kind of had to charge in Maryland because that's where he lived. That's where the appropriate place to charge Snowden would have been.
Marcy, you just reminded me that the WikiLeaks grand jury investigation has also been taking place at the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Eastern District of Virginia. So I just wanted to say that to add to what you had to say there.
And Jeffrey Sterling. So, I mean, and again, Jeffrey Sterling should have been charged in Missouri. He was charged in this same district. And they just do funkier stuff. They have precedents. They, you know, the jury pool is a lot of people who believe in spookery. And so, right, they're going after these exotic cases and getting these precedents in EDVA. And Snowden probably should have been charged in Maryland instead.
Turning now to this Yahoo story, both the intelligence community and the internet giant have been pretty mum about these revelations. I know Yahoo came out and said that they issued this sort of a non-denial denial that suggests that the program was likely running but is no longer running on their system. There's conflicting reports about how this came to be, under what authority the U.S. government required Yahoo to do this. Is this a new intelligence program that is being reported on? Is this a facet of something we already know about? What's going on here?
It's not my best guess, and partly because he FOIA'd and wrote a book on the FISA opinions that would relate to this. I'm guessing that New York Times, and which includes Charlie Savage, is closer than Reuters. Not that the Reuters journalists aren't great journalists, just that Charlie really knows this quite well. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing it's not a new program. What it is an application that most people aren't that familiar with. And that is the NSA, rather than always, the NSA has for years, since Snowden anyway, has tried to lead you to believe that the only thing they target when they target internet communications is an email address. Right. So if they want to target me, they're going to go after empty wheel at blah, 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 blah. And they're going to get everything associated with the email address. And what they don't tell you is they're also going to get every other thing I do at, say, Google. And that includes cookies and so on and so forth. But what the NSA has also been doing is redefining a word that's really important in the law, whether it's 702 or individualized FISA orders, called facility. And that's what they're allowed to target under traditional FISA. And it used to be that facility would be just an email. And then in 2004, a secret FISA judge said, no, no, we'll let you make it a telecom switch so that they could collect all the metadata from a telecom switch. And then 2007, another secret FISA court judge said, oh, I know, we can let you target any internet identifier that you have decided is Al-Qaeda related. And already at that point, it probably went from being just email to IP addresses and, you know, online messaging identities and so on and so forth. And sometime between then and 2011, the NSA then expanded that and said, well, we want to use a crypto term, or we want to use a code that appears on a terrorist communication, or we want to use the code for the logo in a particular organization's business stationery, right? And so all of those things are things you can search for online and find and then read the communications or read the communications of the people associated with that. And that's legal now. That's stuff that the FISA has secretly approved a long time ago. They just never told us about it, and the government didn't really want to tell us about it. And so what appears to have happened is this is what that request was. I'm guessing, and this is a guess, but it's a pretty well-educated guess, that it's the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, because the New York Times said it was a state-sponsored terrorist group, which pretty much only means them, and that there's either some kind of encryption or some kind of tool that they used in conjunction with Yahoo email. We know that they use Yahoo email from other Snowden documents, and that what the NSA, what actually FBI did was tell Yahoo, we want you to go find any incidences of this signature. And Yahoo chose to do that, not consulting with their security people. By all internet companies have like a spam and kiddie porn filter.
Right.
You know, we know that Google gets to read our email. And so that they piggybacked on that function. And in addition to reading your email to find out what kind of ads they could serve you and find out whether you were downloading or emailing kiddie porn, they also looked for this signature that the FBI convinced the FISA court was associated only with this state-sponsored terrorist group. So it's not a program per se as an application of FISA that has existed since at least 2009, 2011, that the government doesn't like to talk about. What's new about it and really important, though, is that we've known that this happens on telecom switches. The government claims when it happens on telecom switches, it happens on switches that are outward facing. So in other words, that would by definition generally carry international traffic. That's kind of bogus, and the NSA has ways to cheat that in any case. So in other words, to make my email to you go across a switch that is supposed to be an international switch. But at least there's this claim that they're collecting communications where one of the parties is by definition going to be overseas and therefore targetable. Here, it's all of Yahoo's users, and all of their email would have been scanned. And one reason they have to do that is because Yahoo switched to end-to-end encryption, and so they can't do that. They can't go ask AT&T to do that anymore, which is what they used to do. Now they have to go to Yahoo and ask them to do that. So it'll be an interesting discussion. We'll see how much the government actually confesses. I think it's fairly clear from the Reuters report that even the intelligence committees didn't really know what was going on. And I know that actual surveillance skeptics in other parts of Congress are asking some important questions now. So it's actually a really timely leak for us, because it's going to tell us a lot more about how these systems work in advance of the reauthorization of the big Section 702, which is
at the end of next year, right? That expires at the end of 2017.
Yep, but we're already talking about it, so.
Yeah, that's a good thing to have heading into that debate. We're fresh out of time. Marcy Wheeler, follow her online at Empty Wheel. Check out her website to find her reporting, emptywheel.net. Thanks so much for coming on.
All right, thanks for having me.
More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Sam, you smell something?
Smells like justice?
Oh, yeah. That sweet, sweet smell of justice in rotten eggs. That's right, folks. It's time for the garbage can. All right. Here come our highly paid garbage interns dragging the garbage can into the studio.
Whoa. Easy there, fellas. Easy there.
Place it down gently. Don't spill any of the trash.
Yeah, we need all that.
All right. Without further ado, here they are. Your garbage candidates of the week.
Garbage candidate number one, UK Prime Minister Theresa May. So the Conservative Party held its first conference with May as head of the party and head of the United Kingdom. Before I read May the Riot Act, just listen to what she had to say. It pretty much speaks for itself.
Not only will we remain committed to spending 2% of our national income on defence, but we will never again, in any future conflict, let those activist left-wing human rights lawyers harangue and harass the bravest of the brave, the men and women of our armed forces.
So Sam, you're looking kind of confused.
No, I agree. When I think of human scum, I think of human rights lawyers, clearly. Clearly, when I think of evil, it's human rights lawyers.
Yeah, no, it's obviously, you know, the Godwin's law, right, of arguing with debate. It's you don't want to be a human rights lawyer.
Right. Just don't compare anybody to a human rights lawyer, whatever happens.
That's what I was thinking. Encouraging atrocities, the dehumanization of foreigners, and a lust for blood, it's all enough in just one 20-second soundbite to earn the Right Honorable Theresa May a rebuke on this show. And the Nuremberg Principles in the International Criminal Court give us the jurisdiction to sentence the Right Honorable Theresa May to the garbage can. Something, I have a feeling, that might happen this week.
I've got a feeling it might too, but we still have other garbage candidates to get to, including garbage candidate number two, political reporter over at The Hill, Jordan Fabian.
Has a little less power than Theresa May, but
yeah,
go on.
A little bit, but hey, we're equal opportunists when it comes to throwing people in a garbage can. You know, someone is going to do it every time there's a natural disaster in the U.S. occurring around the time of an election, which is politicize that disaster. And Jordan has already stepped up to be that guy. In an article on The Hill published well before Hurricane Matthew even made landfall in Florida and published after it killed hundreds of people in Haiti, Jordan speculated on how the storm will affect the election. He writes, quote, Hurricane Matthew is bearing down on the southeastern United States with possible political consequences in the weeks to come. That's what he said in a post titled, quote, Superstorm Sandy Politics Shadow Hurricane Matthew. A classic example of extremely trite reporting, Jordan explains how since Hurricane Sandy hit during the 2012 election and helped President Obama look presidential in dispatch of Mitt Romney, then surely there will be a political fallout from this storm, too. Though he admits, quote, the circumstances surrounding this year's storm are different. Obama is not on the ballot, and Matthew is expected to make landfall farther out from the election day, meaning the focus on the storm could wear off by the time voters head to the polls.
Thanks for that, Matthew.
Yes. For a Beltway reporter in Washington, D.C., the focus on the storm will wear off, for sure. For the people who are getting completely wrecked by the storm and will have to deal with it for years to come, your cheap political analysis means absolutely nothing. So for contrived and tone-deaf reporting, Jordan Fabian, you in your article could be riding out the storm in the garbage can.
Garbage candidate number three, Jesse Waters. So if you don't know who Jesse Waters is, congratulations on not working in media or just not watching bad TV. He does Man on the Street segments for Bill O'Reilly, styling himself as something of a funny man. And well, self-proclaimed professional comedian, Fox News, I think you know where this is going. Hint, it rhymes with tacism. Here is how CNN described the Monday bit. The five-minute segment features Waters asking people in New York City's Chinatown about the 2016 campaign on U.S.-China relations. And this is hacky, this is cheap, but so far, passable, acceptable. But Waters also asks his subjects if he should bow when saying hello, accuses a street vendor of selling stolen watches, and asks one stranger if he knows karate, which originated in Okinawa, now part of Japan. Ah. Well, let's not hold the whole of the right to the fire for Waters' painfully unfunny and blatantly racist sins. Even right-wing blog Hot Air called it a crime against comedy, the Daily Beast noted, and The Federalist, another conservative website, called Waters a jackass and a jerk who conflates being mean with humor. Waters, for his part, he did not apologize. He issued, actually, what many would describe as a non-apology apology. My man on the street interviews are meant to be taken as tongue-in-cheek, and I regret if anyone found offense, he tweeted Wednesday. I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you're so offended. If you have to explain, it's a joke, Jesse. As a political humorist, Waters also tweeted, actually, you know what? I'm going to stop right there. There's an important prerequisite to being a humorist. You have to be funny. Jesse is kind of funny looking, though, thinking his ass is Rob Lowe, looking like a racist D-list David Schwimmer. Either way, Jesse Waters might after today be delivering his next man on the street from the garbage can.
Yeah, quick note on Jesse Waters here before moving on to the other candidates. What was it after the White House Correspondents' Dinner where Ryan Grimm of the Huffington Post fought him?
Ryan Grimm fought Jesse Waters.
That was
Waters.
Good. Yes.
Shout out to Ryan Grimm.
Maybe it was more of a scuffle. I don't know if any real blows were landed.
Whatever.
It's good.
That's definitely way more badass, I'm sure, than the other confrontations that happened after the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So, props to Ryan Grimm.
I feel like you're suggesting something there that you know about, but
no, I'm just imagining the typical White House Correspondents' Dinner celebration. Oh, wasn't the president great? Oh, his opponents were gracious.
It was so funny.
It was just so funny. Although Larry Wilmore, you know, I haven't actually watched that speech, but I heard it was pretty good.
You haven't even watched. Okay, let's move on to garbage candidate number four, Hillary Clinton campaign strategists.
Ugh.
The candidate is shedding support from millennials as the race drags on. Polling has shown more and more of them opting for a third-party candidate in November. Of course, that's not to blame millennials for Clinton's struggles. After all, it's old people, not young people, who are overwhelmingly breaking for Trump. But in order to stop the bleeding, Clinton campaign strategists came up with a brilliant idea. This is really is like very smart idea. You're going to love this, Sam.
Yeah.
They're going to send someone out on the campaign trail who is, and I don't really have any other way to describe him, but as a complete rock star for millennials. I mean, this is the guy that millennials want to be. Millennial men want to be this guy. Millennial women throw their panties at him every time they see him.
Okay, can I guess maybe there was that picture of Hillary with Kim Kardashian?
Oh.
Could it be Kanye?
Good guess. No, not Kanye. Someone even more popular among millennials, even a bigger heartthrob or creative genius among millennials.
Okay, well, maybe not a creative genius, but millennials love this guy, and he apparently his politics are okay. Total heartthrob, Ryan Gosling.
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah.
Another good guess, but no, not Ryan Gosling. You ready for it? You want to hear it? Are you ready?
Yeah, sock it to me.
I'm referring, of course, to Al Gore. Al Gore, ladies and gentlemen, a hero among millennials.
I'm pitching a tent right now.
Okay, seriously here. A flawed presidential candidate in 2000, a completely uninspiring figure. Someone that millennials have probably pretty much completely forgotten about until his name was just mentioned. Al Gore is who the Clinton campaign is dispatching to appeal to millennials. And I don't want to be hard on Al Gore. I'm not throwing Al Gore in the garbage can. I feel for the guy. He had an election stolen from him. Nader had nothing to do with that. It was the Supreme Court that stole the election from him. and a bunch of voters in Palm Beach County who couldn't understand the ballot because it was overly complex.
And Jeb Bush for disenfranchising tens of thousands of black Floridians?
Yes, yes. And I respect Al Gore's climate advocacy, but come on. Thinking Al Gore is the guy who's going to rope in millennials? If you think that, you're in way over your head in this presidential politics game. And maybe those strategists should stick to some less important matters, like a strategy to get out of the garbage can once you've been thrown in it.
Al Gore, was Tom Daschle busy?
All right, let's. We got two more garbage candidates here. Garbage candidate number five. I really don't want to do this, but Gary Johnson.
Again.
Look, I don't think it serves much of a purpose to take cheap shots at a third-party candidate, especially when the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates are just so, so deeply flawed. Particularly the Republican one. But Gary Johnson needs to seriously get his act together. Former governor of New Mexico and current presidential candidate for the Libertarian Party keeps having those what he described as Aleppo moments. A reference to that time he was asked what he'd do about Aleppo, and he confidently responded, "What is Aleppo?" Anyways, the New York Times reports that during an interview with the candidate on Wednesday, Johnson, quote, conspicuously sought to avoid another misstep. Asked if he knew the name of North Korea's leader, Mr. Johnson replied, "I do." There was a pause as reporters waited for Johnson to then name the leader he just claimed to know the name of, who is, of course, Kim Jong-un, but Johnson didn't. "You want me to name the person?" he asked, then paused before adding dryly, "Really?" Times noted that Johnson declined to supply the name. He then complained that Hillary Clinton was being judged on her base of knowledge rather than her interventionist instincts. He said, quote, "Because Hillary Clinton can dot the I's and cross the T's on geographic leaders of the names of foreign leaders, the underlying fact that hundreds of thousands of people have died in Syria goes by the wayside." Which is true. Good point, but still, man. How do you not know who Kim Jong-un is? Really? Really, the guy is like a pop culture figure now. We all just sort of know who Kim Jong-un is.
Also, how do you think that not knowing who Kim Jong-un is, or knowing who Kim Jong-un is, but refusing to state his name is somehow some sort of principled stance?
That's like a tactic you use in elementary school. Like, yeah, of course I know the answer, but I'm just not going to tell you about it.
Yeah, another thing you do in elementary school is stick your tongue out and look all awkward in front of women, girls,
yes.
Which is what he did in that NBC interview. He looked like a kid on the chess club trying to impress one of the popular girls.
Yeah, Casey Hunt, the reporter there, just looked completely horrified during that interview. Look, I think there's some old dirty newspapers in the garbage can. Maybe it would serve Gary Johnson well to spend some time inside studying those newspapers.
All right, moving on now to garbage candidate number six. Wasn't really sure how to classify these candidates, so we're just going to go with clowns in Tucson, Arizona.
Talk about John McCain?
Nope.
Okay. Actual clowns.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so you may have heard about this. You may have seen a headline or two about this one. Apparently, there is a craze sweeping the nation involving teenagers and young men dressing up as sinister-looking clowns to scare children and others. I'm not going to rehash all these incidents, but we'll note that local cops have been called a number of times.
In fact, one clown has been shot as a result of this. It spooked so many people out that someone shot a clown earlier this week.
You know, I'm not sure. I think that might not actually be true.
Oh, I just spread some internet rumor that I heard on our show?
You may have, but your intentions were good, and it's also possibly likely. There could have very well been someone who...
I'm going to scramble and just look through all the news archives around the country, and just if I can find one incident of a clown being shot this week, I'll stand by my statement. But well, I guess in the meantime, I will retract it.
It was a result
until I get further information.
It was a result of the controversial "Stan Your Clown" law.
Okay.
So suffice to say, the professional clown community in the U.S. is worried. But when clowns in Tucson, Arizona, got together to push back against this PR problem, they created another one. I'm now reading from the International Business Times. More than 100 clowns are expected to show up to a gathering in Tucson, Arizona. A flyer for the march read, "This is a peaceful way to show clowns are not psycho killers. We want the public to feel safe and not be afraid. So come out, bring the family, meet a clown, and get a hug."
Let me just say, before you name the event of this thing,
that is
exactly what a psycho killer would say. "We're not psycho killers. Just come out, bring the family, meet a clown, and get a hug."
Yeah, I also don't know why they wouldn't offer balloon animals, you know, like balloon swords. Like, that's the only, you know, I feel like of all my clown memories as a child, those are the most positive ones, of a clown being like, "Hey, you want a balloon dog
or a
balloon
sword?"
Yeah, those were cool. And I would like, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
But nope, not a balloon animal, not a balloon sword, a hug.
Mm.
But that's not all. That's not all. The name of the event is Clown Lives Matter.
Ugh.
I can't even read the joke that I wrote. This is so inappropriate.
Yes.
I mean, this event is just so inappropriate. Clown Lives Matter.
Yes. Co-opting a very serious issue around black men being killed by cops.
Who get away with it all the time.
Who get away with it. Clowns. Yeah, it's
nice. And for the record, in that context, yeah, I don't think a clown was ever shot.
Okay, well, I'll look into that.
We'll look into that. We'll get back to you.
All right, so we've got our garbage candidates. We got clowns in Tucson, and they're co-opting of the Black Lives Matter movement. We've got Gary Johnson, who doesn't seem to know a single world leader or thing in general. Hillary Clinton's campaign strategist for thinking that Al Gore is their secret ticket to bring millennials on board. We've got
Jesse Waters, Jordan Fabian, and Theresa May.
All right. Who do you like here?
I don't know. Who do you like?
Look, Theresa May said something that was completely awful. I think what she said was probably more awful than any of our other candidates here. I mean,
yeah.
Clinton's strategist, that's expected. They've run a poor campaign all along. Gary Johnson. He's done that.
Yeah.
I'm down for either Jesse Waters or Theresa May here. And I will say that Jesse Waters has gotten a lot of public ridicule for his report already.
I don't think there's anything really worse than like openly encouraging atrocities.
Yeah, yeah. So for that,
Theresa May,
you are going in the garbage can.
Oh, into the rubbish. Oh,
some leftover fish and chips in there, huh?
Oh, there's a racing form.
All right, that'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for next week's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.